Hello and welcome back to the Now Age podcast with me, Ruby Warrington. Now, this week's episode is featuring somebody I met at the end of last year who's written for The Numinous and who I've been quoting continually in conversations ever since we first began talking and collaborating. His name is Will Su, and he is a psychiatrist based here in New York City. We first met when Will and I were introduced because I was putting together a panel for our Club Soda NYC event series on psychedelics and sobriety. And Will, in the current iteration of his career, is very, very invested in forwarding the conversation around therapeutic use of psychedelics. Will, I'm going to ask you more about that sort of further down our conversation, I suppose. And I am very interested in that. But also, there was something you said that day in the panel that I have been repeating to people all over the place, whether in workshops, whether on retreats, whether just in general conversation. and it's something that resonated so strongly with me because I think it really taps into the whole reason I created The Numinous and what I'd see as the real potential as many of the tools and practices that we cover on the site. It's making me emotional, like even before we started talking about it. Will, you said on that panel, you know, how you talked about how we have created in our society the need for mental health professionals because of the way that our society is structured now. We've sort of created this role where we have to go pay people to help us kind of navigate our mental and emotional health issues. And that's just, it really, really struck me, I think, because I've witnessed so many people in my life personally and experienced myself this idea that with the right support from community, from friends, we can actually, we do have the capacity to heal many of the, or overcome many of the challenges that we find ourselves faced with. Of course, there are times when we need professional help, right? But I'm really curious if we can just kind of like dive straight in with this subject. If you could unpack that statement for me a little bit, what you meant by it, and how that kind of applies to your work now.
Yeah, it's interesting because just before we started recording, we were talking about kind of challenges of questioning, you know, patterns in our lives that we've held for a long time. And so for me, I've had like three really big low points in my life. And I think the most recent one happened when I was in my early 30s. I had started my psychiatry training at Harvard Medical School. Part of my path there and interest took me to working in Ethiopia. And so we went twice to implement two types of research projects. And it's the second one and the second visit that really struck me to really realizing, you know, about this topic that you had just brought up. The second time around that we had gone, I had a lot of interest in psychotherapy. And so out in Ethiopia now, there's still only about 50 some odd psychiatrists in the entire country. Mm-hmm. And my goal for this trip was to implement a psychotherapy curriculum for the psychiatrists there, because right now they're only working with meds. And I was like, well, let's help them develop psychotherapy. And I think it was, you know, I was really going in with the typical Western approach of we know better than this third world country. And I got there and I was explaining to numerous people, like both people just in the community, but also mental health professionals, and because they were like, what's psychotherapy? They've never heard of this. And they had said, you know, well, it's, and I was telling them, I was like, you know, well, you come to me, you sit down and, you know, it's completely confidential and you can tell me anything you want about your problems with your family, with your friends. And, you know, and it can be really healing. It's a safe space for you. And over and over and over, it was literally like, they looked at me like with these innocent, beautiful like eyes and smiles. And they're like, why would I come talk to you? And I have my friends and my family. And that was really touching to me. And it wasn't just touching, but it was also, it took a lot of reflection to really look at that, because if what I were to accept and what I felt in my heart and what they were telling me felt very true, that really it's about just having these human connections with, you know, naturally with people in our lives and not having to go and pay someone to do this. The reason why I think it was also difficult was because I've spent all these like years training to do this. I think total between my psychiatry residency and all my education post high school, it's about 19, 19 years straight. And so to accept that this thing that I invested so much time, energy, and money into this education really, you know, wasn't what was really healing for people. So it really started this difficult path of what do I do with my life? And that's when I, you know, really learned about psychedelics and really started a path to real healing, I think. And just to talk a little bit more about, you know, specifically that comment that I had made is that I think in the Western world, because we've really started to judge certain emotions that we have or certain, or we think of them as weak and that they're not acceptable, you know, in society. And those emotions that I think about are sadness, fear, and shame. And since we tuck those away so badly, and that, you know, in a way we have a generation of parents that doesn't know how to actually deal with those emotions in kids, you know, we suffer a lot from what we call mental illness. And you know, I think a lot of these diagnoses and disorders that we've developed and made manuals and definitions over actually really are just, you know, a set of symptoms that we have that results from not being able to have those emotions felt by each other. You know, because I think, you know, the most effective therapists and the most effective therapists that I've had or that when I am that for people, you know, the traits are, you know, being sympathetic, empathic, providing a safe space, non-judgment, and curiosity. And really when I started thinking about that those are really the most important traits to have, I realized that that's not really a therapist or a psychiatrist. That's just a good human being, you know, and literally like we've got to pay someone to do that because we've screwed up so badly in our developing community in the Western world.
So much to dive into there. And I just want to reflect back actually something that just came up in that last thing. You were describing the list of traits of what it is required to cultivate in ourselves to be able to hold that space for others, I suppose. Yeah. I just led my first Sober Curious retreat. And when we opened the circle for the weekend, I asked everybody to repeat, I'm entering this space with curiosity, compassion, and non-judgment. Mm-hmm. And to me, those three qualities are what give permission to whoever is sharing, to whoever's being heard and seen, to just fully be themselves and to fully express what needs to be expressed and have it be held and witnessed in a way that's very healing. So that was, it's really interesting that those three kind of adjectives popped up there as well. So could you talk a little more about why it is you think that We no longer have the capacity to do that for each other, or why we've been led to believe that we do not have the capacity to hold these spaces for each other?
Yeah, so you know, I've given that a lot of thought in terms of why it is, and I think it has some to do with capitalism and what you know this kind of buzzword that's been popping up now in the last year or two, toxic masculinity. You know, I think about, you know, the Western world and what we've really been built on is colonialism and greed and accumulation. And it reminds me of a quote by, Russell Brand. I can't remember the exact one off the top of my head, but he said something like, greed is sold to us as capitalism or something like this. And so basically we're
so smart.
Yeah. And you know, because I think about this in the you know, point of view of like, I remember thinking about hoarding disorders in psychiatry, where you know people will fill their houses with all sorts of meaningless things, newspapers or cleaning supplies. And then I remember thinking during the time when you know people talked the 1% came up or the 0.1%, and I can't remember what the number is now because it's changing all the time. I don't know if it's like 0.1% of the United States owns like 30% of the wealth or something like that. And I thought about that to myself. If 0.1% of the population had 30% of the toilet paper, or 0.1% of the population had 30% of the orange juice, like we would call them hoarders and we would call that a disorder and that they should see a mental health professional. But somehow, because it's this thing called money, this piece of paper, like somehow that's become normal. And that reminds me of another quote. I'm someone who loves a lot of quotes, but this one's by Jiddu Krishnamurti, who says, it's no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. And really that things that have become completely, you know, normal and acceptable, I think, are things that are really causing us a lot of suffering. So in thinking about capitalism and toxic masculinity, you know, I think about, you know, toxic masculine traits, which I think of as greed, competitiveness, again, like hoarding behavior, entitlement, as opposed to true femininity or true feminine qualities. Because I think there's also such a thing as toxic masculine, healthy masculine, toxic feminine, and healthy feminine. I don't think masculinity and femininity in my definitions are not linked to gender, even though I think in a lot of the conversations seem to link those. But to kind of circle back is that I think the things that make people, you know, quote, good or successful at capitalism are not what's healthy feminine. It's really you have to behave in this toxic masculine way. And so I think we've started, you know, judging in those emotional states. So I think of six emotional states when I think of as kind of the basics when I start working with people, just teaching them about what are you feeling? Because we're also, you know, part of the problem also is we're a culture that doesn't even know what we're feeling. We're not teaching kids because parents don't even know. What am I feeling? So I think of six basic emotions: anger, sadness, fear, shame, joy, and sexual arousal. And the three, and one that, you know, the one emotional state that I think is very much connected to capitalism and toxic masculinity is anger. Even though, like, you know, verbally we'll say that, you know, so it's so horrible that, you know, Trump says X, Y, or Z, or so, you know, so and so. It's like, anger is still pretty well accepted. It's happening all the time, and it's okay. It's okay to yell at people at work. It's okay to put people down. It's okay to be a jerk to people on the street. You know,
or even to resist, like vocally and angrily, what we see as wrongdoing. So it's seen as productive, and it's seen as powerful. I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah. It seems powerful. I like the way that you said that because I had a mentor once that a psychotherapy mentor who taught me that anger is really a cover for sadness, fear, and shame, and that anger isn't really a true fundamental emotion. And it was actually in a situation because I used to really, you know, my persona was that as an angry person. Like, literally, if you met anyone that knew me before 5 years ago, I see you laughing, and that's what people laugh at me when I say that these days. Like, literally, I have, like, one friend from college, one friend from medical school, because, like, people, if you ask anyone from that time, they'd have been like, Will's a jerk, he's competitive, he only looks out for himself, and it was true. And I realized in talking to this mentor, and he's like, you know, he's like, when you act in an angry way, he's like, you're just puffing yourself up, like a rooster, a peacock that's about to fight or needs to show off. He's like, you're feeling weak every time you're angry, and he's like, that makes you feel stronger in the meantime, but it's not a real confidence or a real strength. He's like, you're feeling sadness, fear, or shame. And that
it's interesting, just to kind of like just to interject very quickly, I often think of alcohol as very kind of connected to the emotion of anger. And what you're describing, it's almost like when we get angry like that or competitive, it's like taking a shot of kind of liquid courage in a way, which is actually covering up for what sensitive or vulnerable feelings we might be experiencing underneath.
Absolutely. And you know, when I think of those so-called, you know, the emotions that we are, again, thinking of weak and, you know, that we need to cover up, sadness, fear, and shame, those are not emotions that are still well acceptable in community. You know, again, I think of how angry Trump is, and he's essentially almost getting more popular and more powerful. But if he were to cry or have, quote, a nervous breakdown tomorrow because he's so afraid, Democrats, I think, and Republicans would finally be like, let's get him out of there. But he can be as angry and as greedy as possible, and we're still very divided around him. And so I think, you know, as a culture, we really need to embrace those emotions and see them not as something weak. You know, and when it ties to capitalism, again, sadness, fear, and shame aren't something that help, you know, a company grow or to accumulate more wealth. You just can't. And certainly not joy and sexual arousal. I mean, if you know, those emotions are really more about sharing and loving and having community. And so that's a theory that I have in my mind.
Although if you think about capitalism, everything it tries to sell us is linked to joy and sexual arousal, pretty much.
Yes, but it's linked
to... You will be happier, you will be more attractive.
Yeah. And it's I think it's also a masked happiness, a masked joy and a masked sexual,
but that's what I mean. The messages of capitalism are basically playing on the fact that we've been taught to want to experience more of those states, those emotional states, than the lower octave or whatever it is. So fascinating. But you spoke as well about how, and this I think relates very much to our kind of social media age, where we hear a lot about, well, social media is connecting us in ways that we've never been able to be connected before. It's also creating a disconnection epidemic where people are connecting or perhaps with many more people, but on a much shallower level.
Yeah.
And I wonder as well, there was something in that original piece when you were talking about this subject about how the breakdown of family and true community has kind of like facilitated this need for outsourcing our kind of like mental health needs, I suppose. Mm. Can you speak a little to that? Like how in this kind of social media landscape can we focus on the connections that are going to be truly supportive and build communities where we can actually really help each other on the path?
Yeah. It's interesting. I've definitely given that that whole topic a lot of thought since we last spoke about it. And I've noticed that I've become a lot less judgmental about social media and technology and stuff. And I think part of it was because I was very unfamiliar and very afraid of it. And I had, because of that, I think assumed, and I just wasn't good at it. Not that I'm good at it now, but I'm learning. But I realized it can be used as a tool like anything else. I just think most of the time we're not using it to its, not to its maximum potential, because I wouldn't say that. I think things have different uses, but I think it has more potential than what it does. So when I had made that comment, I was thinking about like memes that people put out or just statements that people say. It reminds me of just kind of these statements of like, you know, what can only, what doesn't kill you can only make you stronger, or things like that, where it's simply, you know, where people will say the right thing, but then they're not doing the right thing. And so, you know, a group of friends of mine, you know, have really started thinking about this, and even, you know, we started using the hashtag like walk the talk more, or I started thinking about things like show me you have integrity, don't tell me that you have it, you know, because it's really about how we show up and how we're behaving. I think which is what actually makes a difference in our lives and how we're connecting with other people. You know, it also brings to mind this kind of series of ways of showing up in the world that I've been thinking about, which is, you know, kind of, how do I describe it? It's going from thought to word to deed, you know, because I think in terms of being able to show up and manifest in the world the way we want to, you know, those things have to be in alignment, you know, and I think of thought as really a first part where things like family, culture, religion have mixed up what we actually want to do. What is our real integrity? And we don't even know what we want half the time. And I think, but when we can really connect to emotions, like deeply in our bodies, like we actually, I think, very much know what we really want to do, how we want to show up in the world. Like, you know, do we really want that corporate job of 70, 80 hours a week? Or do we want to play and create and make music and art, you know, but society tells us, oh, you're never going to make a living doing that, or that's not something that's admirable. And so I think when we first link our thoughts, you know, into a way that's with our own individual integrity, I think then we can move to word, meaning that's when we're talking with integrity to other people about who we are or who we want to be. And this brings up, you know, this book, The Four Agreements, that I think you and I probably and many people listening know. And the first one of those never sat well with me, which is be impeccable with your word, because this reminded me of again, the age of memes that we're in, where, again, are just speaking and not actually following up with action. And so that's when I go from thought to word to deed, which is acting with the integrity. It's, you know, speaking out when you're seeing something happen out on the street. It's about even, you know, posting when you know, our close friends are being perhaps acting with anger or some sort of violent behavior on social media, only attacking Trump. Because, like, actually, there's some things, not many, but I'll say that some of the things that Trump has done, I'm actually like, I actually think that was a good thing. I wish Obama had done something like that. But half the time, I don't even say that out loud because I feel like I'll just ostracize my friends. But it's really got, you know, about really being able to speak up when we feel strongly about something and not feeling like we're going to be judged about it. So, you know, that thought, word, and deed has become a very important kind of a way of looking at the world for me.
And I think communicating in that way and really, following that model, thought, word, deed, in our relationships is how we build really strong, unbreakable, trustworthy relationships. And it's that element of trust, I think, that's perhaps missing. I remember reading some statistic recently where they were comparing, you know, stopping random people in the street and kind of comparing their responses to the answer, like, do you generally believe that people are trustworthy?
Mm.
And I can't remember the time scale, but it was like 20 years ago, that number was like in the 60%. Mm. Now it's more down in like the 20% or something.
Oh my gosh.
And it's just like this idea. And I think part of it is this kind of meme culture where there's so much information and so much being said that so often feels disingenuous and is designed to get likes, to get something, which again plays back into the capitalist mindset of like, everything I do has to be generating some kind of a perceived reward, you know, rather than just contributing for the sake of contributing.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Interesting. And I think, speaking of memes, my dear friend Alexandra posted a meme on Instagram just yesterday, and it was something along the lines of, pay attention to who you're checking in with and who's checking in with you. And I think this idea, and we in our close friendship group have created very, very consciously and purposefully a sort of a checking in with each other, a culture of checking in with each other.
Mm.
Haven't heard from you for a while. How is it going?
Yeah.
You know, let's make sure we actually all meet up in person this month. We're all so busy, but let's actually put this in the diary and you know, actually prioritize it over other opportunities that might come up.
Yeah.
And that has been I found that to be such a beneficial way of kind of operating within my friendship group. Because I realize otherwise it's so easy to have all of these quote unquote kind of throwaway text relationships with people where I don't actually end up getting into a space where I can really offload what's on my mind or really kind of feel like I'm being seen and held by people who have my best interests at heart.
Yeah.
So I think that we can consciously kind of create those small communities for ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, it reminds me of, because I'm certainly still doing a lot of self-work on myself, and especially in the realm of being better socially or improving my interpersonal communication. And I was in Costa Rica recently. I was talking to a friend who I found to be very, beautifully engaged with people, and I admire him for that. And I asked him, I was like, you know, do you have any tips for me? And he gave me this beautiful one, actually. I think he said about, you know, 7-8 years ago, he was trying to work on himself as well in this realm. And I can't remember the name of the exact title of the book, but that's 36 Questions to Fall in Love with Anyone or something like this, where it's a beautiful, actually, set of questions where they get deeper throughout the 36 questions. Like, it'll start out by just, like, saying, I think the first question is, if you could take anyone out to dinner, who would it be? But at the very end, it'll get deeper and deeper. But he said to himself, I think it was initially billed, I think it was a New York Times bestseller for sure, but people were like, oh, this is, you know, a dating thing, or, you know, if you really want to get romantically close to someone. But he started doing these things with his friends where, you know, where people are having one conversation. Often we'll get together with 8 or 10 people and, you know, everyone's having side conversations, but what they would do is actually go through these 36 questions and only have one conversation at the table. So everyone would go around in a circle answering these questions in a deeper and deeper format. And I've tried it now a couple of times one-on-one and with groups, and it is absolutely beautiful. I mean, like, we could do that. Again, that doesn't cost money, because sometimes people think about healing. We were just talking about this before we started recording about, you know, does, you know, what role does wealth play in healing and in publications and books and speaking? But this is, you know, real healing doesn't take money. You know, literally, like that example that I just gave you. I mean, I think, I've also suggested it to people. Some have tried it and everyone's like, that was mind blowing. It was like so beautiful. That costs nothing. Like, you could look up those 36 questions on, you know, I know they're on, you know, just Googleable.
You could buy the book. As an author, I would recommend you go buy the book and support the author in their work. But it's interesting you say that, because actually one exercise that we didn't do on the retreat, which I may do in future situations, my Sober Curious retreat, throughout the book, Sober Curious, there are tons of questions about a person's relationship that may come up as someone's investigating their relationship to alcohol. They get kind of like, they start off quite surface and then they get really deep and very existential in nature towards the end.
Mm.
And I thought a cool exercise would be to just go through the questions that are in the book, and then have a group answer them and go around the circle. So you don't know what question's coming next, and they're just consistently getting deeper and deeper as you reveal more and more to each other.
Yep.
So I think, I might try that one.
Okay. So just to, I guess, if we are giving credit to people. So the book is called, 36 Questions That Lead to Love.
Awesome.
So if anyone wants to check that out.
Yes, it sounds great. I think one thing I like about social media is that when used consciously And when a person is able to curate a community that feels supportive in their social media feed, it can be a place to express oneself in ways that feel vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And from positive feedback received or empathetic feedback received, to actually feel quite supported. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we see more and more people being very open about their anxiety, about feeling overwhelmed, and about other sort of mental or emotional health issues, and feeling there's a lot of communication about how healthy it is actually that people are feeling more free to communicate about these things and are feeling less shame about maybe experiencing difficulties in that realm. However, I'm also really wanting to hear your thoughts on the best ways when we are feeling overwhelmed, when we are going to those dark places, which we all do, the best ways of actually caretaking ourselves, so that we don't wind up isolating and that we don't get into a situation that may be dangerous, you know? I just, what is kind of like best practice for someone who may be feeling extreme anxiety? I think it's very hard not to be feeling anxiety if you're an empathetic person living in the world that we are.
Yeah.
Going through these times, you know, it's an extremely change, I think, is something that we're probably the most afraid of. And we're going through a period of like very intense and rapid change that feels quite uncontrollable. So it makes sense that people are feeling more anxiety, I think. But yeah, what kind of advice have you got in terms of somebody just really caretaking themselves, and equally for anybody who may see a friend going through a very difficult time? What's the best way to caretake ourselves in those situations?
I'm finding myself first thinking about what you just said about social media, and I want to make a quick comment about it, is that I do think social media can provide a beautiful platform to connect and to, you know, as you said, maybe have sympathy or empathy when we're going through certain situations. I also think that one of the problems is too wide of a reach, and it makes me think of this quote that I was thinking about recently. Or actually, no, this wasn't. I actually came up with this one.
One of your own.
Where it says, like, the lack of complexity leads us to live in our complexes. And meaning, like, if we're, you know, and I think of, you know, an example of that is, there's another quote that I want to read briefly. I said this one earlier. I've always thought that some of the things that people suffer from the most are the things that they tell themselves are not true. Because I think we can find support for anything on social media. If we post anything on Facebook or anything on Instagram, we will get a certain number of people that will support it. And I think if we're not, you know, and there's a certain, another quote that I had made in that when I was thinking about these same topics is that complexes have currency. And by complexes, I mean narratives that we tell ourselves, like I am a victim, like generally as a human, like a victim that defines me versus saying I'm a victim of a circumstance.
Yeah, right.
Because
my parents were X,
yes.
Therefore Y.
Yes.
So
if we live in these complexes, they protect us from certain things, or they provide
like
us with certain things.
Way.
Yes, but they will also keep us from other things. And so, you know, if we're posting anything, and again, we not to mention Donald Trump or put in too many plugs for him, but really, like, look how many social media follows he has, and look how many likes he has. And I think sometimes if we choose to, again, not look at our lives with complexity, like, we can live very inauthentic lives. And in a way, again, I feel he has a lot of suffering because he feels so much support from a certain number of people. He actually thinks that what he's doing is right.
Mm.
And it's keeping him from really perhaps doing the healing work as well.
Mm. So in the case of just regular little old me... posting something like, you know, I'm feeling so sad today, or I never seem to be able to overcome this, or whatever it is, and then getting positive feedback about that will in a way reinforce that as a truth.
Yeah, none of this stuff is black and white, right? It's just, what are the responses? But I think, you know, the beautiful ones, you know, to anything being posted is when we get those messages, the individual ones in our inboxes, and a friend says, hey, yeah, I've actually really gone through this. Thanks for sharing. Or this really helped me.
Mm.
I've been going through this also. Because that to me connects to empathy, which I think, you know, one of the things that we talked about when we did that talk together was about the importance of empathy, of true empathy and healing, you know, where I think about empathy, not like sympathy. Sympathy is the short responses or the like. Sympathy says, that sucks that you were going through that. I'm so sad for you. Versus empathy, really, the definition that I really like is that the experience that's the understanding that another person understands our experience, our felt experience, and that really understands how difficult or how sad or how scary that was for us.
And largely I think of because they felt it themselves also.
Because of that, and but you know, the hard part is that, you know, not everyone has, or almost nobody has gone through that exact situation or the set of circumstances that led us to go there. So it's really just saying, I feel you. And again, that doesn't even require words. That can be like as simple as a hug, like when we're kids, like literally going back to that time, like, yeah, that sucks. Like, you know, Johnny smashed my pen or stole my favorite XYZ, or, you know, so-and-so didn't invite me to their birthday party. Like, you can sit there with a child and you can say, oh, well, Alyssa, you know, in 8 years, once you're in college or when you're married, you know, what's happening, you know, right now in fifth grade isn't going to matter. There's nothing empathic about that. To that little girl, that means the complete world. And so if someone comes up crying like that, what about just like a really tight, beautiful hug? You know, that really just says, I feel you. This is painful. And it's that simple, you know, but you know, some people hesitate to really, or you know, because we really want to do our best to help someone feel better, we usually try to like do something about it, like try to change the circumstance versus just like feel what's happening. And that's what I found that is really the key component of really healing, to really listening to someone.
Just being with someone, I guess, in person is ideal. Yeah. It's interesting. I do actually think this is one of my special healing gifts.
Yeah.
I host what I call story medicine circles, which are essentially very ritualized sharing circles where there's a strong emphasis on the listening part as much as there is the speaking and the sharing part.
Yeah.
And the instructions are not to comfort, not to nod and kind of, and not to kind of try to fix, but simply to listen empathetically and really give the full focus of your attention to whoever is speaking in the circle.
Yeah.
I can't help but cry all of the way through then. And I'm kind of looking at people and welling up with tears, and I know that there's something very cathartic for them in that experience of having me there holding that space, like visually showing that I'm feeling the intensity of what they've been sharing, whether it's something very sad or whether it's something very joyful, you know.
And it's so critical, this piece, and again, I think, you know, it's one of the critical ones, really, I think, to really finding true empathic connections. And so it's finding those friends in our community that we can consistently find the most empathy from. But that's also not going to be one person. You know, another danger is feeling that's always one person, because that's not really, you know, healthy for anyone involved, because we're all complex people.
Yeah.
But it's really just being able, and also finding, you know, where is in one friend or another, am I always finding comfort? It reminds me of the story of, I was in Peru not too long ago, well, actually a few years ago, but I'd met this young woman who was traveling there from France, and we felt very connected, et cetera. And I opened up my heart to her, and I was like, oh my God, I like you so much. Like, I'd love to spend more time with you, et cetera. And it was really impressive, because she was just like, she's like, we're in different places right now. We still have a lot of growth, et cetera. And then I started crying, and we were up on this beautiful like mountaintop, in Cusco in the Sacred Valley overlooking this thing. And I just started like sobbing, because I was like so sad, so hurt. But she did one of the most valuable things, you know, and this is the sympathy versus empathy thing, where, she looked at me straight. She didn't even look sad. And at first I was just like shaken, and she looked at me and she was like, I don't feel sorry for you. She's like, I'm excited for you. She's like this piece of healing that you're doing, you know, going through like, you know, what you think that you want, you know, trying to look at it from the outside. She's like, you're on the path to really finding that for yourself. And it just obviously it felt like a big stab in the gut right away. But once I actually sat with it, like, she gave me a huge gift, you know, because it was really, really what I needed at that time. So meaning like, you know, I if I had posted about that and people are like, oh my God, how sad, I don't think I would have been able, that catapulted another chunk of healing for me. And just being like, yes, this is an opportunity for me to like grow and love another part of myself. So
she was acknowledging the part of you that she saw as infinitely strong enough to get beyond this and go off on another path. And very, very cool. This is kind of leading this conversation into the talk about psychedelics, I suppose. And again, back on that panel, something else that I've quoted you a ton, don't worry, I always credit you. was you were talking in depth about the need or the value of evocative versus suppressive therapies. And I sort of feel like empathy is, in a way, an evocative therapy in and of itself, right? Can you sort of, again, unpack that a bit? What do you mean when you talk about evocative therapies versus suppressive therapies, and how do you see the role of both in the way that we are, in the way that we're able to heal ourselves?
Yeah, so I think this is absolutely critical to healing. You know, when I think of, you know, when we talked about the six basic emotions, and especially the three that I think of currently in culture that are, you know, quote, intolerable or thought of as weak or being vulnerable, which is sadness, fear, and shame. And again, there are things that we do all sorts of crazy behaviors or actions to, like, try to hide those, basically. And, you know, those are the ones that we think of as suffering, you know, sadness, you know, equaling depression, fear equaling anxiety disorders, where, you know, we see how much we want to just, like, get rid of those. We don't want to feel those. We think that there's something wrong with us, you know, and that could be from alcohol or nicotine or certain sexual behaviors or outlets that are simply to not feel those.
Shopping.
Yeah, shopping.
Social media.
Absolutely.
All of these things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was sad when I, you know, because I do think that there is truth to being able to really, really show those emotions, you know, for the, at their fullest, which allows the empathy to happen, because another, you know, we have to be able to express that. But that really, you know, the cultural influence is hindering that. You know, it actually shook me even more when I realized as a healthcare professional that the people practicing medicine and practicing psychology often don't understand that. And not only do they not understand it, but often they're playing into the same complex, if you want to call it that. And, you know, it was most striking when I thought of, you know, the medication classifications that we use: antidepressants, anti-anxiety meds, antipsychotics. It's like all of these symptoms, and we're basically saying as practitioners, let's get them away from here, instead of saying let's bring them to the surface and let's deal with them.
Anti, so, implying we're going to use this to kind of cancel out or just get rid of that
emotion. Yeah, where I think of like, you know, Ativan, Valium, Xanax, which are all benzodiazepines, which are they're called anxiolytics or anti-anxiety medications. I think of those really as just being alcohol in a pill, you know, and they really are literally, that's how they work in the brain, the same exact way that alcohol does. So sometimes I have patients that come in the beginning and they're saying, oh yeah, I'm completely sober. Yeah, I'm just on Ativan and I've, you know, just 2 milligrams the last 3 years, but I haven't touched a drink in 3 years. And when I, again, this is the part where I'm like, I'm not going to lie to people. I'm saying, like, it's literally alcohol in a pill. Like, you're taking this because you're feeling X symptom and you want to get rid of it. And I don't really blame those people, because it's the doctors that are out there prescribing. Because, and it's also, I don't blame the doctors, because we're doing the best we can. And, you know, the really engaging authentically, finding empathic community or finding an empathic therapist cost a lot of money. It takes time and it's a lot of effort.
And there are very few, there aren't very many signposts or even places to get information about that. So,
And so, you know, I think, you know, I don't blame anyone. It's just the situation that we happen to be in. But this is where psychedelics are exciting, because psychedelics like MDMA or LSD or psilocybin or ayahuasca, right? These are things that bring, they evoke emotion. They don't suppress emotion. They bring old memories or old emotions to the surface where we can deal with them. And so that's the conversation that we had had before. And, you know, one of the other pieces of the messages that I'm liking to send out is to really educate healthcare professionals on this, because even though if these medicines become available, if we don't really understand why they're so effective and how they're working so differently, you know, we may not get the most impact out of them. And also educating people that are interested in using them themselves is also important, in addition to the practitioner, so that we really can make the most out of these for ourselves.
I really want to hear a bit more about your story, actually. So sure. you've hinted a couple of times during this conversation that you had a personal transformation that kind of, like, led your career in perhaps a slightly different direction.
Sure.
I wonder if you could just share a little bit about that. How did you go from this kind of, like, angry, competitive guy at Harvard to the kind of work that you're doing now?
Yeah. Well, that's a... I can't remember how you just worded that. You said something like... I just want to emphasize that I've gone through multiple journeys and transformation. You said a transformation. I've definitely had multiple transformations, and I'm sure it's not over yet. You know, I think this stuff is continuous. So, I mean, honestly, I don't know if I've ever really shared this, but it was actually, I was realizing that I wasn't being completely honest with you earlier when I said a supervisor had given me that piece of advice about, you know, anger comes from sadness, fear, and shame. It was actually a therapist that I was seeing at the end of medical school. I was actually dating someone who is still very near and dear to my heart. We were very close, and we always send lots of love to each other, but it was my longest relationship of my life, almost 8 years. And it's actually not hard for me to admit. I was incredibly abusive to her, emotionally abusive. And when the last time we broke up, and we were kind of in that cycle of break up and get back together and break up and get back together, where I was having a lot of, you know, angry thoughts about her and our relationship and what happened if we didn't get back together. And I was sharing this stuff with my therapist at the time. And that's when he was like, stop the bullshit. He's like, there's nothing strong about you. You're doing this because, you know, you're hurt, because you feel unloved, etc. And that is what really catapulted the beginning of my healing, because I really, like, I couldn't, you know, my mind could not get around that. Like, it was true. It felt to be true. But it also, you know, was really what led to the healing for me, because to say every single time I felt angry towards her or towards my family or towards a friend, etc., this was my shit. Like, this was, I was either feeling sad, I was feeling scared, or I was feeling ashamed. And that, you know, anger in a way was the suppressive mechanism that I had been using to suppress sadness, fear, and shame. So that's when I really started digging into those emotions. Like what was it from my upbringing that led me to feel so lonely? What was it from, you know, the friend groups or the bullying that I experienced that made me feel, you know, so afraid of interpersonal interaction or just not feeling safe in my body? And you know, but before connecting to that, I was just using anger as this, like, external mechanism to not have to deal with the painful things. And so that was really what initiated all of this for me. Within there, there's lots of stories I could tell you about individual things, but that was really, realizing that, you know, I was hurting myself and I was hurting someone else, and that I was not going to tolerate that anymore.
Which is an illustration, I think, of how such a profound change can begin to occur from something. One small kind of like opening led to this whole kind of reevaluation of where, what you needed to heal in order to be able to do your work in the world as well, right?
Yeah.
At what point did you start experimenting with psychedelics, and at what point did that kind of become? What point did that become part of your path?
Well, in terms of experiencing psychedelics myself, so I'm a licensed physician in the United States. There's one experience that I have had and that I will share here. But I will say that, you know, so I learned about psychedelics around the age of 33. So, you know, I'm not like an early bloomer. I was not like a hippie doing drugs all the time. I'd only smoked pot about 5 times in my life before that age. And I was very anti-drugs. My parents raised us Jehovah's Witness. And so, you know, looking at a bong or seeing, you know, a crack pipe used to, like, you know, send chills down my spines, even into my early 30s, because I always thought of these as dangerous drugs. And so it was around that time when I was starting my training at Harvard as a psychiatrist where I started realizing, A, I'm suffering a lot. B, these medicines aren't working for me or anyone else. They're giving people a lot of side effects. Mm-hmm. And, like, this is what I had worked for 13 years of straight schooling to do. Like, this is my career. And I was just, you know, that was really the third really big low point of my life. And it just happened to be around that time that I had been doing a lot of dream analysis in my therapy. And then, you know, to make a long story short, my best friend from growing up had recently started getting familiar with DMT, which is the psychedelic that's in ayahuasca. And for months and months, he was telling me about this, saying I should read about it and stuff. And I just didn't, because I'm like, this is a psychedelic. It's dangerous. And then finally, he told me about a piece of research. He was like, oh, yeah, they used to do research on this in the 50s and 60s, and they found that DMT is made in the brain, and that they think it's released during REM sleep when we dream or when we have near-death experiences. And I looked this up, and most of it ended up being true. And there was, like, a Nobel laureate, actually. There was one paper in particular that I looked up, a scientific paper by a guy who won the Nobel Prize, and he was researching DMT in the human and rat brain. And that fascinated me, because I'm like, wait, all these things that I've been told are dangerous, why was this paper published? Why was this guy putting so much resources into it? And because of that connection with getting a lot of benefit out of my dream analysis, I was like, okay, well, maybe psychedelics can be used to provide to patients. They can provide these experiences, and then we can use them to heal. And so that was really my intro into to psychedelics.
Quick little question there, sure. Then. So DMT is produced in our brain when we go into the REM sleep, which is when we have the very vivid psychedelic dreams, right? So interesting. I was talking about this on the Sober Curious retreat and how alcohol prevents us from going to that part of the sleep cycle, which is why sleep when we're drunk is never restorative, because not only... not only is that the most vivid part of our sleep cycle, but it's also the most restorative. So I, you know, am I completely just kind of working things out, no training on this whatsoever? Yeah. I was like, you can put these two pieces of information together and say, well, there's something very healing and restorative and necessary about entering that kind of DMT part of the sleep cycle, right? Which we're in a way, suppressing with alcohol also.
Yeah, and I would also say marijuana goes in there too. You know, marijuana is also a beautiful medicine. It can also be a way of escape, you know, especially now that there's gaining more popularity with recreational and medical use. Marijuana also suppresses REM sleep, but a lot of people use marijuana to be able to fall asleep.
Yeah.
So it's hard because some people really feel that they cannot get sleep without marijuana, but it also suppresses REM sleep, which is that restful state where I think we are doing a lot of kind of consolidation and healing in the resting state.
We're doing the mystical, I mean, you know, it's when we go to the numinous, it's when we transcend, it's where shamans can take us, it's where we go in hypnosis, it's where we go in shamanic trance, it's like where we go when we're watching movies, actually, isn't it?
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
It's kind of like...
I love that. No, really.
This is my hypnotherapist friend Shauna Cummings told me that. She's like, people are so afraid of hypnotherapy, like it's going to take you out of your body and you're going to be susceptible, that actually our brainwaves go into the hypnotized hypnosis state when we're watching a movie, which I love, because I'm like, why don't we all love movies, you know? We all love to go there.
Absolutely.
So fascinating. So can you tell me a little bit about the, you are working on some official trials with psychedelics currently. Can you tell me a little bit about what's happening currently in terms of the Western medical sort of medicine model and the psychedelic therapy model? Like, is what's happening in terms of integrating the two, I suppose? What sort of trials are you actually sitting on now?
So in terms of like large-scale clinical trials, and especially ones that are on the news right now, there's the MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, which has entered the phase 3 clinical trials for the FDA, which is kind of the final phase before rescheduling and approval. And psilocybin for major depressive disorder, which I think they're about to start phase 3 clinical trials. In terms of my current status, so I had been at the University of Connecticut on the phase 3 trials when we had last done, when we did that event, I think it was last October. And that was a site that was really exciting because we were focused on treating PTSD in people of color and race-based trauma. Unfortunately, that site was shut down at the end of 2018 because of, there was significant politics on the side of the university and the kind of the lead of the of our research site. So currently, my status is I'm preparing a study for MDMA-assisted therapy for fibromyalgia to do with MAPS, which is going to get into hopefully the mind-body connection, which is perhaps maybe getting into your question about how Western medicine and maybe like Eastern philosophy or other healing modalities are coming together. You know, because one way of healing is the mind, right? And healing our thoughts, healing the way we think about ourselves and the way we think about ourselves. But there's an entire part that Western medicine has really ignored, which is the body. And then another piece, the spirit, which I think of as three distinct things. but we're really starting to see that these things are coming together. Like, I actually gave a talk last week to a group of Columbia medical students, and I actually didn't know how many people were actually going to show up. I thought maybe 10 or 15, but it was like 60 people. Wow. I was like amazed, because if this was when I first started medical school, like in 2003 or even 5 years ago, I don't think we even would have got, 20% of that group. So, and it was almost all from one class, so the first year class. And so it just showed how much excitement there is around this stuff. And I remember when I first started medical school, we used to have like a department of complementary and alternative medicine is what they called it. And there was like acupuncture and like meditation. And these things were thought to be these fluffy things that no one actually believed in. And we've come such a long way. And one thing that comes to mind is like the Iceman. I'm not sure if you've heard of him, Wim Hof. They do these breath work and these cold trainings where he like puts himself in like these... these bathtubs full of ice, or he's climbed, I think, to Mount Everest base camp in just like boxers
I have heard of his name,
boots.
Yeah.
And so that ties in beautifully to medicine, because I had heard this story about, like, he was giving a TED talk, I think, and it was like, and I did a research study with scientists. He's like this German man, and I'm horrible at German accents, so I shouldn't even try. But he's like, we took, six people, and we injected them with LPS, which is this toxin, not LSD, but LPS, which is a form of a very strong toxin. He's like, and the people who I trained for just a few days in breath work and cold tolerance didn't mount a fever and didn't mount an immune response. And that was just like, yeah, I was like, yeah, right. There's no way. Like, in what publication would have even, like, scientific one would have published that? And I actually looked it up, and it was published, I think, in 2013 or 2014 in one of the most respected medical journals, like probably top three, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So literally, it was just what he said. He took, like, a handful of people, like a small group, trained them to do this breath work and cold tolerance. And then a group that didn't injected them with this toxin, and they really, the group that he trained did not mount a fever, and they did not mount an immune response, I know that most doctors probably don't even know about that study, but B, like, the implications for mind-body there are tremendous. And so it's really, I feel like psychedelics are one avenue into really bringing, Western medicine and Eastern practices or more ancient practices into really a beautiful synergy, I think, that can be better than either one was separately. And it's super, super exciting. And that science is really supporting this also and is interested in it is even more exciting.
It is very, very exciting. Yeah. One last thing I kind of want to touch on here. I feel like I could talk to you about this stuff today. I'm just endlessly fascinated. But you've mentioned as well how a lot of people are doing, becoming more aware of this conversation around psychedelics. There's a lot of what you call underground healing happening.
Yeah.
And I know this is a real passion subject of yours as well, which means, people finding access to certain substances and kind of using it for themselves and among friends as a way to have healing experiences.
Yeah.
For anybody who's interested or is considering or has even been kind of experimenting with that, what are, again, some kind of I suppose some guidelines, anything you can recommend to people who are who've maybe heard about this and are curious?
Yeah. It's a hot topic, and it's an important one because, after Michael Pollan's book, everyone's looking for an underground therapist. Like, I don't know how many emails and phone calls I get a week from people saying, oh, yeah, I saw you from the MAPS website. And, some people flat out ask me if I can do underground therapy with them, or some people, like, I'll get them on the phone and they're like, yeah, I know you're not saying this now, but if I come in or if I fly to New York, I'm like, no, like, no. And I've heard, I know some underground therapists, and it's incredible. Like, the underground therapy community has been there really strongly since things were made illegal, like in the early 70s. And I think we should be very grateful to them. They've carried along a lot of the work. We've learned a lot from the underground therapists. But even then, I think in New York, like, there's like a 2-month wait list for even the underground therapist. So it's very needed. I also think that, it's not necessarily people need to be weary, because I think there's a lot of underground therapists popping up that don't really know what they're doing. And I think so, but there are also many underground therapists who are doing a great job. And I think that's also true for licensed therapists. I think some are doing a great job and some are not, even the ones who have been trained to do this work. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, first is just making sure that the substance that you're getting is as pure as possible. I mean, that's one huge thing, because you just want to know what you're putting in your body. Mm. And that's a complex subject in and of itself. Mm. Another one is to really just make sure that you're in the right safe set and setting, that you're in a good place, that you're in a good location and a good surrounded with people that you trust. I think, there's all sorts of bad things that can happen, but I think, just trusting your gut, not going with the first person that you meet just because, it's been so hard to find someone, and finally someone answers an email. If it doesn't feel good, don't go for it, because it's probably also hard to really, if something goes wrong, to really do anything about it, because, like, that would be admitting to any authorities that you were involved in something illegal too. So it's messy. So I really think trusting your gut and just also trusting and waiting that for the right opportunity, because I think there's so much excitement on psychedelics right now that, one of the things that we were talking about earlier, again, in that important, really important piece about healing being about giving and receiving empathy, psychedelics aren't a part of that. You know, they can be a part of it. They can be a helpful tool, but it's not a solution. You know, the way it's being painted in the media some right now, I think as a research community, we can be doing even better to emphasize that, like, these are not silver bullets. These are not one-shot deals. This is not you're going to go to the Amazon for a week and come back and you're healed. Like, you've got to really do the work. And so, you know, I tell people that, like, you know, so if you don't have a psychedelic therapist right now, you can't find someone, that it's okay. You can keep doing the work. It doesn't mean that, like you're in a, you're going to stay unhealed until you find one. Because yeah. I think if you are feeling that way, that, yeah, like, my life is awful right now because I can't find an underground therapist, that's a bad sign for the person, I think, because that means they're putting all of their kind of chips in that basket, and that's not good for anyone.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting, actually, thinking about this idea of calling it underground therapy. Sounds kind of edgy, and it's hints to the illegality of it.
Yeah.
And yet, on the other hand, we've got people very openly talking about their ayahuasca experiences, life-changing trips to experiment or to experience this substance, and it doesn't necessarily have that same charge to it of edginess now because it's become so normalized to talk about going to Costa Rica to do ayahuasca or whatever it is. And I remember when we very first met, you were equally warning, I suppose, of people when entering into or thinking about trying a substance like ayahuasca to go about it with the same level of caution and patience, for really waiting for what feels 100% like the right opportunity, and not just kind of, like you say, going down to the jungle in the Amazon, like going along with the first shaman that you meet. Like, that can be risky.
Yeah, and not all psychedelics are created equal. You know, I think some are made more for people who have a strong spiritual or connection to shamanism versus some people who are, say, more, who are in a Christian state and don't want to, like, you know, see jaguars or past generations of family members. They just want to heal of stuff of this life. And I think, you know, just to quickly say, like, you know, I think there's two ways of thinking or picking a psychedelic experience. And it's really honoring that, A, you can have psychedelic experiences that will help you integrate, you know, difficult or traumatic experiences of your life, or you can have a psychedelic experience which you will need to integrate into your life. Mm. And the latter one is especially important to think about, because, you know, if one smokes all, you know, NMDMT or 5-MeO-DMT, or goes to Costa Rica or Peru and does ayahuasca for 2 weeks, like, those are pretty jarring experiences. And those, again, can simply not only help what's happened in the past, but they can be traumatic sometimes for people that are unprepared, or they're going to locations that are just massive, trying to bring in anyone and aren't really doing due diligence and checking with people and how they're doing, and how they were doing. It's really just about the business aspect.
Bringing it back to capitalism.
So it's just again, it's just being true to yourself and following your gut. The thing about that I also want to mention is ketamine. That's not something we've talked about too much, but ketamine is, it's been in the news a lot in the last year. And in the last 2 weeks also, the FDA approved, or I think is approving, I think by next month, a version of ketamine called S-ketamine that's being pushed by Johnson & Johnson. That I'll say is not, so S-ketamine in of itself is a gimmick. It just briefly, every chemical molecule in nature has a mirror image of it. It's called the racemic mixture. So literally, like, if you've got like a phone or a mug and you hold it in front of a mirror, it's like the mirror image, but it's not identical. Chemical molecules have that too. One trick to get around patents that pharmaceutical companies do is that they will take the mixture of the two mirror images, separate them after a patent is over, and say, oh, look, this one works even better. And in theory, it's a new molecule or a new compound, and so they sell it as something new. So ketamine's an old medicine that's been around forever. It's incredibly safe to use. It's also got its risks, but it's being found to be incredibly helpful for depression. And so Johnson & Johnson, I think it's nice that they have entered the market, because I think it's going to help legitimize this stuff. But I also think it's a danger, because there's probably going to be some effort to say, oh, like, this one's better than the cheap generic one that you can get. But again, this is an above ground treatment that is available. It's not widely available yet, but I've been doing it for about the last year in my clinic. And there are more people that are doing ketamine assisted therapy, which is different than ketamine IV therapy. Ketamine assisted therapy combines ketamine with psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I've been working with a lot of success with my patients. I've also been a client of ketamine assisted therapy myself, and it's been incredibly valuable. And over the next year, I'm going to be moving from just doing this work with patients, but actually training psychotherapists and psychiatrists to use it themselves and to hopefully be able to start their practices so that, you know, this medicine can become more widely available. So that's something, again, it's weird because as I talk to people about it, the data is actually really good around ketamine, but somehow there's not so much excitement about it. And I think it's because it's not as sexy as MDMA or psilocybin because it's not illegal or underground. It's like, but I'm like, wait, we have this thing that works really well right now.
And in terms of it being like, I feel like, you know, magic mushrooms, ecstasy, these are kind of party drugs. So people associate them with glamour and good times in a way.
Yeah.
Whereas ketamine, I mean, I certainly think about it from my kind of experience brushing up against it. I haven't ever taken it recreationally, but it just always seemed kind of like, you can't really party on ketamine. You can, but like you're going to end up in a kind of a dribbling mess in the corner, right? Yeah. It's just not so glamorous, like you say.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely ketamine, again, has its ups and downs. And, you know, I do think, I have little doubt that there's going to be a ketamine epidemic. And it's kind of sad. And the reason is because ketamine, even though it's a powerful psychedelic, it can help access those difficult emotions, those difficult memories. It can consistently be anti-anxiety in nature. It can be anxiolytic. So people feel disconnected from their difficult emotional states. And I think I've seen people in, you know, the Burning Man and the rave community suffer very much from this. Some people who are very close to me, and it's really difficult. And that is a worry going forward, is that, ketamine is not all. Yeah.
Well, nothing is. And I think just to kind of like piggyback on what you said about psychedelic therapy isn't necessarily for everyone. Mm-hmm. I'm super fascinated with this subject because I see the potential in terms of helping people who might not have had maybe some of the tools or experiences that I've had in my life to kind of to kind of get in touch with their emotional life. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a mother who trained to be a psychotherapist in her late 50s. She qualified at age 60, having been through her own extensive mental and emotional healing process, which obviously as a child I witnessed in close-up detail. Yeah. And I think as a result of having had that experience with her, this incredible Pisces woman who only ever wanted to talk about her feelings, I've got very used to and good at and comfortable with talking about difficult emotions, right? So personally, I don't really feel the need to explore psychedelic therapy. I've had sort of psychedelic experiences with things like breath work or even in yoga sessions. And because I feel like I'm very naturally in touch with that part of myself.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of like finish up this conversation to my listeners as well. Yeah, I talk about psychedelic therapy all the time because I'm very interested in the potential, but it's not something that I plan to partake in myself. I don't feel the need for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just to say that by having conversations like these, neither one of us is saying to everybody out there, go and do psychedelics and you'll be healed. Yeah. It's just like, here's a really interesting way into a conversation about the importance of feeling our feelings rather than suppressing them.
Yeah.
And that's actually the key to the healing process. It's the feeling of the feelings.
Yeah.
Whatever tools we have to get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
The more access we have to the tools that we to get there, then the better for everybody.
Exactly. They're simply another tool. And yeah, absolutely. This is not that this is for everyone, that everyone will benefit. That is absolutely not the message that I think I or you are trying to send here. So yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Will. This has been fascinating, as always.
Yeah.
I know that listeners are going to find it really useful too. Any questions, feedback, shout out on social media. DM us, though. We like the DMs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Will. And I'm sure we'll collaborate again soon.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks, Ruby.
So much of what we spoke about in this episode really gets to the heart of all of the work that I do, actually. Whether it's sharing and giving access to different healing modalities via the Numinous or simply talking about getting sober curious. I honestly believe that removing the intoxicating substance of alcohol from your life is probably the number one easiest, cheapest, it's even going to save you money, guys, and most accessible way to really start to learn how to sit with some of those more difficult, complicated or less acceptable feelings that we all experience and which are all super valuable. This, as Will pointed out, and we really got into in this episode, is literally how we learn to begin to learn to heal ourselves and actually to process some of the feelings that society would rather we didn't experience.
So thank you for being here. I think that the more of us who can get comfortable with this conversation, the more of us will be able to help others to heal from their more difficult traumatic experiences in life also. Thank you for being here. As usual, if you sign up for our newsletter over at the Numinous Instagram, which is at @_Numinous, there's a link there in the profile to sign up for the newsletter. You can get this podcast delivered to your inbox each and every Thursday so that you never miss an episode. You can also, of course, subscribe on iTunes. And please let me know who you're interested in hearing from, if there's anybody in the modern spiritual wellness space that you would love to hear talk in depth about their subject, then let me know. That's all from me for now. I will see you next time. This podcast features original music and is edited by alloaudio.com, www.alloaudio.com.